Marco Werman here with a little announcement before we get to the show. Today is Giving Newsday, an opportunity to show your support for high-quality, nonprofit news like The World. When you donate to The World today, your gift will be doubled. Make your gift and a huge impact at theworld.org/match. That's theworld.org/match. And thanks for your support. NATO is marking its 70th anniversary this week. President Trump said today the organization serves a great purpose, and the French president should be more respectful.
And I heard that President Macron said NATO is brain dead. I think that's very insulting to a lot of different forces. And you just can't go around making statements like that about NATO. It's very disrespectful.
Also, an American hacker is at the center of controversy with North Korea.
On the surface, it looks like, you know, cryptocurrency bro goes to North Korea to help them.
And want to revive a Native American language? Record a version of Baby Shark.
There's no easy way out of our predicament of language loss.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The North Atlantic Alliance got an endorsement today from someone who's not always been so supportive.
NATO serves a great purpose.
President Donald Trump was speaking in London ahead of the NATO summit. NATO, of course, is a collective defense alliance. It includes the U.S., Canada, and 27 European nations. It was originally formed 70 years ago to counter the danger of aggression by the Soviet Union. Today, though, Trump was defending NATO against criticism from French President Emmanuel Macron. Macron had said the organization was suffering brain death. Today, Macron said he meant it.
I know that my statements created some reactions and shaked a little bit. A lot of people. I do stand by.
Trump took issue with Macron's criticism of NATO.
And I heard that President Macron said NATO is brain dead. I think that's very insulting to a lot of different forces. And you just can't go around making statements like that about NATO. It's very disrespectful.
Trump even went on to say that he could foresee France breaking off from NATO.
Nobody needs NATO more than France. And frankly, the one that benefits really the least is the United States. We benefit the least. We're helping Europe. Europe unites and they go against a common foe that may or may not be a foe. Can't tell you that. But there are other foes out there also. But I think nobody needs it more than France. And that's why I think that when France makes a statement like they made about NATO, it's a very dangerous statement for them to make.
All that made for a tense joint press conference for Trump and Macron earlier today. Perhaps to help ease the tension, Trump tried out some humor.
Would you like some nice ISIS fighters?
Look,
I can give them to you. You can take everyone you want.
Let's be serious.
Let's be serious, Macron said. Then he proceeded to explain the continuing dangers from ISIS. Despite his defense of the NATO alliance today, Trump did repeat a long-running complaint on defense spending, calling some member nations delinquent, calling out Germany in particular. UK Ambassador to the United Nations Karen Pierce has been watching NATO's 70th birthday party from her perch in New York. She says despite sharp words, NATO is here to stay.
It's the most successful alliance, I think, in history. It guarantees the security and freedom of its 29 members. So I've been very pleased to see it in London.
We all heard loud and clear French President Emmanuel Macron's declaration that NATO is experiencing its brain death, although Jean-Claude Juncker, former president of the European Commission, says NATO is just in a light slumber. And President Trump has mused in recent years about quitting the alliance altogether. And then today, at a news conference with Macron, Trump had a different take.
So NATO, which was really heading in the wrong direction 3 years ago, was heading down. If you look at a graph, it was to a point where I don't think they could have gone on much longer. Now it's actually very strong and getting stronger.
So Ambassador Pierce, today President Trump seemed to embrace NATO, even enthusiastically. How do you explain that change of heart?
I wouldn't actually agree that NATO had been going in a downwards direction 3 years ago. I think NATO has some very important strengths because it's based on collective defence, and that's enshrined in what's called Article 5. And it means an attack on one nation in NATO can be considered an attack against all. And new members continue to want to join it.
But Donald Trump has dismissed NATO in a big way, and even though he sees its vital signs as turning in a proper direction, whatever that means, I mean, he still will be found to insult the organization.
I think the president has been particularly focused on the cost of NATO to the US compared to other NATO allies. And I think the important thing about that is that the alliance has agreed to do what's called burden sharing. They made a defense investment pledge in 2014, moving towards spending 2% of GDP on defense. That is what the UK does. So we are standing up to it, and we obviously encourage others to do so.
Still, there is a lot of disagreement among member states about what NATO is for and how it should function. What are the key points of friction between the European nations and the US on the purpose of NATO that most worry you, like the real Achilles heels?
I wouldn't acknowledge that it has an Achilles heel, but I think there are legitimate questions about how far NATO should move into relatively new areas of cyber, counterterrorism, possibly even space. But I also don't want to give the impression that the threats in Europe have completely gone away. NATO has troops in Estonia for one very good reason, which is the threat from Russia. And I think allies want to talk about how exactly they can deal most effectively with some of these new areas.
I'm glad you brought up those NATO allies on the Eastern Front with Russia, because President Trump was asked today about whether Russia should be dealt with as a NATO adversary. Here's what he said.
I think it's a good thing to get along with Russia. And I campaigned on it. I mean, I go into big stadiums. People like it. And I think the Russian people would like to see it, too. A lot of good can come out of it.
So apparently at Trump's rallies, they like it when he shows his good relations with Russia. The UK and the US do not exactly see eye to eye on Russia right now. Where do the two nations differ on how they view the Kremlin?
I don't think it's that we have a difference on how we view Russia. What made a big difference, of course, to the West view of Russia was the invasion of Crimea. And because of the Salisbury chemical weapons attacks in the UK, for which we judged the Russian military intelligence GRU to be responsible, we probably have fewer automatic connections to Russia, whereas I understand that the Americans probably have more official dealings with Russia, comparatively speaking.
Ambassador Pierce, there's a lot of polling and conventional wisdom that President Trump is widely unpopular in Britain. Why do you think that is?
I wouldn't accept that the president's unpopular in Britain. I think there is a lot of respect in Britain for the US administration, and people are pleased that the US president has visited for the NATO summit. There's huge affection and understanding and respect for America as a whole. That doesn't depend on one individual administration. And it was, of course, cemented during the Second World War and in the NATO alliance that came along 70 years ago. So I think there's an enduring friendship and solidarity there that transcends politics, to be honest.
UK Ambassador and Permanent Representative to the UN, Karen Pierce. Thank you.
Thank you.
In London today, protesters hit the streets to show their enthusiastic support for a sprawling, decades-old national bureaucracy. Yeah, you heard that right.
Not for sale! NHS, not for sale!
NHS, not for sale, demonstrators were chanting. The National Health Service in the United Kingdom is unlike anything we have here in the U.S. Sure, Brits will tell you that their state-funded network of healthcare facilities is far from perfect, but the NHS is also widely seen as an institution that is worth protecting. And as the world's Ilana Gordon reports, there is public anxiety about the future of the National Health Service.
The NHS started in 1948. It's completely tax-funded, and anyone who's in the UK can use it. Unlike healthcare in the United States, services are provided at no charge, and medicines are highly subsidized. And none of this is really controversial.
Whether you're a very elderly person or whether you're a young mother or your child, everybody's entitled to free, universal, comprehensive health care of a good quality and standard.
Louise Irvin is a doctor in London. She says she's immensely proud of what the National Health Service does for the UK.
Nobody has to worry ever about not being able to afford to pay medical bills. If somebody gets cancer, of course they worry about the cancer. but they don't have to worry about whether they can afford it.
Irvin says she's witnessed this firsthand. She's been a primary care doctor for 3 decades. But she and others have also witnessed parts of the National Health Service begin to erode in more recent years. Funding and staffing levels have not kept up, and that's not good for patients.
If it's an emergency, what we're finding now is people are waiting many, many hours in the emergency department. And even if they're not then considered to be ill enough to require admission to a hospital bed, there aren't enough beds for them.
That's also got people who work for the NHS worried. The National Health Service is Britain's largest employer, with something like 1.7 million employees. Today, Louise Irvin joined a group of NHS workers to protest outside Buckingham Palace. The occasion was a visit by President Donald Trump.
Say these three words loud and clear so they hear us in those buildings. Our NHS is
not for sale.
Thank you.
We very much want to protest about the potential impact of a trade deal between the US and the UK, where we fear that aspects of the NHS may well be on the table.
Irvin and others are worried about what happens to the NHS in a post-Brexit trade deal with America. Back in June, President Trump was asked about this.
When you're dealing in trade, everything's on the table. So NHS or anything else.
But in London this morning, Trump backed off the idea.
If you handed it to us on a silver platter, we want nothing to do with it.
But the British public's underlying fears have been growing, and the future of the NHS is a big election issue.
What I have here is something I can reveal to you.
Last week, Jeremy Corbyn, the opposition Labour Party leader, released documents showing the details of preliminary trade talks between the US and the UK. A key part of those discussions show America's desire for its pharmaceutical companies to get into the UK market. The implication from Corbyn was clear. Drug prices in Britain would go up.
Lives will be put at risk as a result of this.
In the current UK system, the government controls drug costs and uses cheaper generic equivalents. Mark Dyan is a healthcare analyst with a think tank called the Nuffield Trust.
There are some good reasons to worry about medicine pricing in a trade deal with the USA, but you also have to understand protests against it in the context of wider UK politics.
He says the public's fears about the future of the NHS are tied with the start of the Brexit story.
At the end of the war, Britain created the NHS.
That's a political ad from the anti-Brexit campaign ahead of the vote in 2016 to leave the European Union.
In the actual referendum campaign over whether or not to leave the EU, the side in favour of leaving the EU made great play of the idea that we could redirect some of the money that we have to pay to the EU as members into the National Health Service.
Let's imagine what else this money could buy. State-of-the-art hospitals.
Dyan says the pro-Brexit campaign overestimated how much money the UK would gain for the NHS after it pulls out of the EU. But
I think that does tell you that quite widely across the UK political spectrum, there is a lot of commitment to the idea of the NHS, partly founded in politicians' fear of voters who have a very deep connection to it.
Fast forward to today. The UK's general election is just 10 days away. Recent polling finds the NHS is a top, if not the top, election issue. Boris Johnson weighed in today, saying that the NHS is not for sale or up for negotiation in any future trade talks. For The World, I'm Alana Gordon.
It's a real estate developer's dream, an exclusive community perched in the valley of a beautiful mountain range, 4,000 new apartments with all kinds of fancy facilities, including ski slopes and a stadium. You sold yet? It's in North Korea, specifically the town of Samjiyon. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un calls Samjiyon an ideal socialist village. At a ribbon-cutting ceremony, Kim hailed the new town as one of the country's most important construction projects. The crowd went wild. Samjiyon is located near Mount Paektu, where Kim's father, Kim Jong-il, was reportedly born in 1941. Earlier this year, the son was pictured riding a white horse up to the summit of the mountain. This new modern ski village will be enjoyed by North Korea's elite. Much of the rest of the country still suffers from shortages of food, fuel, electricity, even running water. And according to one observer, there's evidence that forced labor was crucial in the 2-year construction project in Samjiyon. You're listening to The World. Hey there, listener. Today is Giving Newsday. This is an opportunity for you to show your support for the independent nonprofit journalism you hear on The World every single day. When you donate to The World today, your donation will be matched. Your $40 donation becomes $80. Your $80 gift becomes $160. Giving Newsday is only one day a year, so don't miss your chance to double your impact. Go to theworld.org/match. That's theworld.org/match. And thanks. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The U.S. government has announced charges against an American hacker. Authorities say he taught North Koreans how to evade sanctions and launder money by using cryptocurrencies, you know, digital currencies like Bitcoin that people and countries can use anonymously without being tracked. Here's The World's Lydia Emanuelidou.
In the early 2000s, Virgil Griffith was getting a lot of attention.
A 24-year-old hacker named Virgil Griffith, he created something called Wikiscanner, a website that traces Wikipedia edits to the computer networks where they originated.
This is from the Colbert Report back in 2007. In the years since, Griffith's made a name for himself in the hacking and crypto world. He works for the Switzerland-based Ethereum Foundation. That's the company behind the cryptocurrency Ether, one of Bitcoin's rivals. Griffith is an American citizen who lives in Singapore. And last week, he traveled to the U.S. And when he landed in Los Angeles on Thursday, on Thanksgiving, he was arrested.
A message came through in a group chat that I'm a part of. And my personal initial reaction was, oh my God, Virgil, what did you do?
This is Taylor Monahan. She's the founder and CEO of MyCrypto. That's a tool that lets people manage their cryptocurrency assets.
I know Virgil, and I know him as a good person. I know him as someone who is always sort of trying to connect people.
Monahan started seeing headlines that made it look like the story was,
you know, cryptocurrency bro goes to North Korea to help them.
Stories that said Griffith had given North Koreans information about how to evade sanctions and launder money. She says this seemed totally out of character.
Myself and most people in the cryptocurrency community and most people who know Virgil, their gut reaction was shock. And what the heck, and how did this happen?
I reached out to Griffith's lawyer several times. So far, no response. But here's how U.S. officials describe what happened in their criminal complaint. Last April, Griffith traveled to Pyongyang for a cryptocurrency conference organized by North Korea's Committee for Cultural Relations with Foreign Countries. U.S. passport holders have to get permission from the State Department to travel to North Korea. And according to the complaint, Griffith applied and was denied, but he went anyway. While he was in Pyongyang, officials say he broke a law that prohibits Americans from giving goods or services to North Korea. In this case, by giving the North Koreans a presentation and, quote, highly technical information on how to use cryptocurrencies to evade sanctions and launder money. Let me take a quick pause here and say that North Korea is already doing this.
We already have substantial information on how North Korea uses, and I would say embraces, cryptocurrencies.
Priscilla Moriuchi is with the security company Recorded Future. She used to work for the National Security Agency. She says that over the past few years, North Korea has acquired hundreds of millions of dollars in cryptocurrencies. Remember, this is money they can use anonymously. The whole system is decentralized, so not controlled by any government, and regulations around it are pretty lax.
So when you kind of layer all those things on top of each other, it's really a perfect operating environment for a country like North Korea, right, that wants to stay or needs to stay outside of the international financial system.
So it makes sense that North Korea might want information from someone working with cryptocurrencies. But friends of Virgil Griffith say this is not what happened.
Of all the people I know, Virgil is the person least likely to help a regime like North Korea. He speaks out against this sort of thing all the time.
That's Eric Corley. He's the editor of the Hacker Magazine 2600, where Griffith is a contributing writer. He says Griffith did go to North Korea, but he didn't do anything wrong there, didn't give them any information they couldn't find themselves online. But here's where he says Griffith messed up. In May, the month after the conference, Griffith was in New York, and he agreed to meet with the FBI. Corley warned him against it, told him he should get a lawyer.
And he was so convinced that they meant him no harm, that he had nothing to hide, and he just went there on his own.
Corley remembers seeing Griffith the next day.
And he was so happy. He said, yes, I gave them North Korean newspapers. They were very interested. He basically, in his naivete, thought that just telling the FBI what he knew was the wisest course of action.
Griffith spoke with the FBI at least one more time in November. He was arrested 2 weeks later, and if convicted, he could face up to 20 years in prison. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou.
Parents of small children, brace yourselves for what I'm about to play. If you have kids, this song has probably become a permanent earworm. The song and an animated video were released by South Korean educational company Pinkfong in 2017. Since then, it's become an international hit, translated into a bunch of different languages. Here it is in Thai and Russian. Come on, tell me that isn't catchy. Anyway, there will soon be another version of the viral tune, this one in the Navajo language. Pinkfong is partnering with the Navajo Nation to release it. Manny Wheeler is the director of the Navajo Nation Museum, and he joins us from Window Rock, Arizona. How did the idea to do this come about?
Well, we have a few movies under our belt that we've had the pleasure of helping dub. We dubbed Star Wars Episode 4 in Navajo. That was our first project. So one of the things our team really wanted to cover was something that was early childhood. So Pinkfong was a very high candidate for us, and we reached out to them, and they responded relatively quickly.
Manny, your museum, the Navajo Nation Museum, works to preserve and showcase Navajo culture. How does making this Baby Shark song do that?
By going directly to the core of our culture, and that's our language. So to truly understand ourselves, we really need to understand our language. There are philosophical teachings that are embedded in our language about our culture.
What kind of impact do you hope this all actually has on the language?
So there's no easy way out of our predicament of language loss. And that's across the board for all native tribes in this country and probably around the world. Ultimately, it's to bring awareness that we must start doing things about our language, that we must be conscious. And these projects have absolutely hit a home run doing that.
Manny, help us out with a little Navajo lesson. How do you say shark in Navajo?
Shlo'hushke. And it literally means fish with a bad temper.
I have to ask you this, Manny. Are you prepared for hundreds of aggravated Navajo parents who cannot get the song out of their heads?
I would say that I think parents are going to be happy that children are going to be speaking Navajo, even in this simplest form.
Manny Wheeler is the director of the Navajo Nation Museum, speaking with us from Window Rock, Arizona. Thanks very much. I can't wait to hear it.
Oh, thank you.
This is The World. Add Argentina, Brazil, and France to the list. The Trump administration is threatening new tariffs this week. That kind of protectionism worries economists.
This seems to be a core part of Trump's worldview. And it's extremely problematic in a global economy where supply chains are global.
I'm Marco Werman. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, and PRX. Mount Tariff erupts again. That was the headline from the Wall Street Journal's editorial board, Mount Tariff being President Trump.
I happen to think that tariffs for our country are very powerful. You know,
we'll face tariffs and taxes.
We're collecting billions and billions of tariffs.
I'm defending America's national security by placing tariffs on foreign imports of steel and aluminum.
This time, President Trump is threatening tariffs on Argentina, Brazil, and France. Joining me now is the world's Jason Margolis, who follows the president's trade policies. What exactly is the new tariff threat here, Jason?
So President Trump is imposing tariffs on steel and aluminum shipped to the U.S. from Argentina and Brazil. And then separately, he's threatening up to 100% tariffs on French wines, cheese, handbags, and a bunch of other items from France.
Why is Trump talking about new tariffs right now?
Well, with regards to the South American countries, he says Argentina and Brazil are devaluing their currencies to get a leg up. So if their currencies are weaker, their products are cheaper for the rest of the world. And those two currencies have fallen, but they've fallen because the economies in Brazil and Argentina have been struggling. Trump also doesn't like the fact that Argentina and Brazil are now selling more pork and soybeans to China, but they're selling more goods to China because of the trade war between the U.S. and China. So their pork and soybeans are cheaper than American pork and soybeans. With France, the tariffs are a response to a tax on American tech companies like Facebook and Google. France says it can't capture revenue from American companies that sell or advertise online in France. And Trump says if they tax us, we'll tax them.
So let me get this straight. Trump put tariffs on China, and now Brazil and Argentina are doing business with China. Did Trump kind of walk himself into this problem?
If you ask him, he'd say no. But a lot of economists would say, yes, this is his own doing.
Why do you think the president is so focused on tariffs in general? I mean, it's really a tool in his toolbox.
Well, the president has been focused on tariffs really since the 1980s when he was attacking Japan, back when he was a businessman making the rounds on all the popular daytime talk shows. And he sees tariffs as an effective tool. He famously said early in his presidency, "Where are my tariffs? Bring me my tariffs," when his advisors were not providing him with enough options quickly enough. I spoke today with economist Lee Brandstetter at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. He focuses on trade issues. And I asked him about why President Trump has been so focused on tariffs, and this is what he told me.
The general obsession of the Trump administration with tariffs, with protectionism, with moving away from free and open flows of goods, services, and capital, this seems to be a core part of Trump's worldview. And it's extremely problematic in a global economy where supply chains are global and U.S. industries are very much integrated with industries around the world.
Jason, when Brandstetter said this view is extremely problematic, I mean, where could it lead?
Well, it could lead to a race to the bottom. More than 1,000 economists sent a letter to President Trump last year stating that his views could repeat errors made in the 1930s. The United States imposed wide-ranging tariffs back then. The rest of the world retaliated, and this helped prolong the Great Depression. And the data shows that Trump's tariff policies are not working, in fact, are having the opposite desired effect. Metal manufacturing jobs are down. Manufacturing is off. Farmers in the U.S. are struggling to get by. Farm foreclosures are way up. Businesses can't operate in this uncertainty. But who does it appeal to? It appeals to his base, who likes that Trump is standing up for the United States and acting tough.
So who exactly is advising Trump? And are they telling him, just focus on the Dow Jones, you don't have to worry about manufacturing and all that other stuff?
Right. So President Trump's main trade advisor right now is an economist named Peter Navarro. And Bob Woodward wrote in his book, Fear, that nearly all economists disagreed with Trump, but he found an academic economist who hated free trade as much as he did. I asked Lee Brandstetter what he thought of Navarro.
Peter Navarro's views are really very, very different from the research mainstream. There's really nothing in his recent writing on trade that really connects to science or research. He is really off on his own wavelength.
So I just should add that Gary Cohn, who was the president's chief economic advisor, who left last year, he said 99.9999% of economists agreed with him that tariffs are a bad idea, which is basically true. But Trump went with Navarro.
Wow. Back to the news, Jason. Are these just threats against Argentina and Brazil, or is Trump going to do it?
Well, President Trump certainly has made empty threats about tariffs before, and it could be his way of getting leverage. But then again, he doesn't like to appear being weak. I guess nobody really knows where all of this is heading.
The World's Jason Margolis, thank you.
You're welcome.
It's that time of year when we head into the glam and glitz that is award season, and we're talking more than Oscar, Emmy, and Tony here.
The Ballon d'Or France Football 2019 is Mr. Lionel Messi.
France's prestigious soccer award, the Ballon d'Or, the Golden Ball, was handed out last night to the best soccer players in the world, men and women. Argentina's Lionel Messi won his sixth Ballon d'Or. For a long time, the award was given only to men. That changed last year when Norway's Ada Hegerberg became the first woman ever to win the trophy.
Obviously, when you see a Ballon d'Or trophy for the women's yesterday on telly and you're, yeah, I don't know, 10 years old, you must be inspired.
There will be many young Americans inspired by this year's Ballon d'Or winner, Team USA's Megan Rapinoe. Rapinoe co-captained her team to World Cup victory last summer. She's outspoken about LGBTQ rights and equal pay for women. Rapinoe is also a critic of President Donald Trump. Not the kind of sports star who's interested in the White House photo op after winning the big match. She just wants to play the game. In fact, Rapinoe was unable to get to the Ballon d'Or ceremony last night in Paris, so she recorded this video message about the award.
I mean, I can't believe I'm actually the one winning it in this field. It's been such an incredible year, and women's football is lucky to have every single one of these amazing players every year. And it pushes us, and it pushes me to be the best player that I can.
In second place for the women's Ballon d'Or, England's Lucy Bronze. Rapinoe's co-captain, Alex Morgan, finished third. Lionel Messi may hold the record-breaking six Ballon d'Ors, but he's now facing double the competition for that claim to fame. Head over to our website to listen to an interview with the first winner of the women's Ballon d'Or, Ada Hegerberg. That's at theworld.org. Stand up beside me. Those are the words that an American woman, Virginia Giuffre, told a BBC television audience last night. She's asking the British people to support her and her accusations against Prince Andrew, a member of the British royal family. Giuffre says she was a teenage victim in a sex trafficking network run by disgraced financier Jeffrey Epstein. Prince Andrew says he can absolutely and categorically say it never happened. The BBC's Dora McIntyre reports.
Virginia Giuffre, formerly Virginia Roberts, has already made allegations that have created a crisis for the royal family. In her first interview for British television, she describes being trafficked to London by Jeffrey Epstein on a private jet in 2001 and then being introduced to Prince Andrew. She says the introduction was made by Epstein and his then-girlfriend, the socialite Ghislaine Maxwell, at her London home. She says they later went to Tramp, a nightclub where generations of royals have let their hair down. Prince Andrew says he has no recollection of what she describes, but she says she remembers him.
He asked me to dance. He is the most hideous dancer I've ever seen in my life. I mean, it was horrible, and this guy was sweating all over me. Like, his sweat was, like, it was raining, basically, everywhere, and I was just, like, grossed out from it. But I knew I had to keep him happy because that's what Jeffrey and Ghislaine would expect from me.
She says that when they left the club, Ghislaine Maxwell instructed her to have sex with Prince Andrew. Later that evening, she says she did as she was told. In an interview with the BBC 2 weeks ago, the prince said he didn't recall meeting her. He said he had a medical condition that meant he did not sweat. And of the claim he had sex with her, he said he can absolutely and categorically say it never happened. Asked about a photo of him with his arm around Virginia Giuffre, the prince said he didn't recall it being taken and questioned whether it was his hand in the picture. But in her BBC interview, which was recorded before Prince Andrew's, Virginia Giuffre says the prince cannot be telling the truth.
People on the inside are going to keep coming up with these ridiculous excuses, like his arm was elongated, or the photo was doctored, or he came to New York to break up with Jeffrey Epstein. I mean, come on. I'm calling BS on this, because that's what it is. He knows what happened. I know what happened. And there's only one of us telling the truth, and I know that's me.
Buckingham Palace says the Duke of York emphatically denies having any form of sexual contact or relationship with Virginia Giuffre, and that any claim to the contrary is false and without foundation. But Virginia Giuffre says she is now calling on the British public to support her.
I implore the people in the UK to stand up beside me, to help me fight this fight, to not accept this as being okay. This is not some sordid sex story. This is a story of being trafficked. This is a story of abuse, and this is a story of your guys' royalty.
The sex life, judgment, and honesty of a senior member of the royal family is under intense scrutiny. Prince Andrew has already been forced to stand down from public life, but the questions about his conduct won't go away.
The BBC's Dara McIntyre reporting there. The Islamic Republic of Iran is going through its deadliest political unrest in years. Protests began in mid-November after a surprise spike in gasoline prices. Iran's government responded by blocking internet access and cracking down violently. Amnesty International says more than 200 people have been killed, thousands more arrested. Today, Iranian state television acknowledged that security forces have used deadly force against, quote, rioters in several cities. Ahmed Mamarian is a deputy director of the Center for Human Rights in Iran, based in New York. I asked him how Iranians are reacting to the government's admission of the violence.
It's very hard to deny killings of people on the streets when the videos are surfacing to the internet and people are seeing what happened in many different cities. And the government has refused to provide any accurate number regarding the number of people who have been killed. But human rights organizations, citizens, activists inside the country are sending their reports out and basically give us the full picture of the violence in the aftermath of the protests in the country.
So the last wave of widespread protests in the Islamic Republic came a decade ago after the very contested 2009 election. How is this wave of protests different from that year? Like, what have you been seeing now?
In 2009, the protests had a leadership and there was an organization to it. It started with a major demand, and that was, where is my vote? And we saw that it started from Tehran and a few other cities, and then it expanded. This time around, it's different because, you know, the protest popped up in more than 100 cities. It was not organized. It was very organic. People who thought that the increase in the price of gas really hurt them. And that prompted people to come to the streets. And that's why it was in many, many different cities, particularly areas that, you know, like people with a lower income, they came to the streets because they are affected most by this policy.
Yeah, typically those demographics of low-income young men especially, those are the ones that the government in Iran can usually count on for support, the people who turn out at rallies. So if unemployed young men are frustrated in Iran, what do you think that says about who Iran's rulers can count on for support anymore?
This is a very good question. These are the people that are the base, like the major constituent of the Islamic Republic. They always pretend that they are the supporters of the poor and the lower middle class, and that's why they are in power. Now we see that their constituent has turned against them because they see that year after year after year, their policies have weakened their economic power, and that the fact that every year they become poorer and poorer. They don't foresee a better future.
You know, some people would say that these protests in Iran are exactly what the Trump White House wanted with its maximum pressure campaign on the country. Trump was actually asked today in London whether the U.S. supported the protesters in Iran, and he said at first he did not want to comment, but then he said no. The answer is no. Do you think these protests are the result of Trump's posture toward Iran?
Well, for sure, Iran going through a very hard time. The sanctions are hurting the economy very bad, and more than anything else, the people. But on the other side, Iran's problems when it comes to economy is much bigger than the sanctions. Iran has been struggling with corruption for many years, and economic inequality in Iran has been vast, and that comes from government policies.
Omid, I know you have family in Iran. How are they doing?
My family, like many others in the country, feel the pressure, and they are very uncertain about the future. Particularly after this round of violence, there's a huge distrust between the government and people. And when there's no trust, it's just so hard to execute any policy. And that, I think that's the overwhelming feeling I've witnessed, not only from my family, but also other people that I've talked to in Iran over the past few weeks.
Omid Mamarian, Deputy Director at the Center for Human Rights in Iran, speaking with us from New York. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Our next guest wants to tell you a story, specifically a story about climate change and what life could look like in a green future. His name is Per Grönqvist. His job is chief storyteller at Viable Cities. That's a government-funded program that's working to make major Swedish cities carbon neutral by 2030. We started off our conversation, believe it or not, with a clip from WALL-E, yeah, that animated movie, about a robotic trash collector on an abandoned planet Earth. Here's WALL-E meeting another robot, Eve.
Name? WALL-E.
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 Per Grönqvist, you say there are lessons in WALL-E that informed your own approach to moving the needle on climate change. What are those lessons?
Every time I watch this clip, it makes me cry because there's so much emotion going on here. And it connects us on a deeper level. It's not about facts or figures or anything. It's about sort of two characters trying to reach out and connect to each other. And that's something deeply moving because it's deeply human about it. So whenever we talk about climate change, it's all about the graphs and the facts and the figures and all that. But it's not that much. How does it feel to be in a climate neutral tomorrow? And when is that tomorrow coming anyway? But if we talk too much about carbon and climate neutral and whatnot, then suddenly it sounds like I'm going to take your car away, I'm going to steal your steak, and you can never go to Hawaii again. So it's about finding that kind of story and use that story to sort of help people make sense of that world.
So walk us through what a sustainable story of the future might look like. Give us an example of a story you might tell about getting the city of Malmo, Sweden, to be more sustainable.
So I want to bring it back to, what does a normal day look like for someone living in Malmö? So they might take a bike to drop off the kids at kindergarten and then get off to work. And then they might find themselves in lunch hour that they're eating something vegetarian or plant-based, but it's really good, it's tasty. And then afterward, they will realize they have 5 minutes extra and they will go for a smoke. That's sort of the life I'm imagining, that we will still have a high quality of life. We will still do some of the sort of stupid things that we love that gives a richness to our life.
Why do you think stories have this power that simple instructions or advice do not?
Story has always been the way people relate information and knowledge to each other. You learn about the world through stories. And then you can fill in your blanks in terms of facts and figures and that. But when you're trying to understand something, you need a story to it. And too often we, from coming from a science point of view or a journalist point of view, where we think, okay, just lay out the facts on the table and everyone will do the right choice. That's the sort of classical myth of the economic man, which doesn't exist at all. We are not logical human beings. We are sort of, I don't know, we're much more like monkeys driven by our sort of emotions that we get every second to do something differently.
I suppose there's also a flip side to this concept, the rise of populism. Can an over-reliance on stories and maybe an under-reliance on facts curdle into something darker?
I think Donald Trump is the very good example of that. Stories will trump facts because the campaign he was doing was not fact-based at all. Whereas, for example, Hillary Clinton was very much fact-based. It's about her cabinet would look like and her plans for the first 6 and 12 and 18 months. And fact can be a bit boring. And he was much better at connecting to a narrative that was brewing out there and saying, oh, I know, let's make America great again. Mm. And that's a story, that's a very powerful story. Even though as a journalist, you can say, okay, I have some follow-up questions. What do you mean great? And when was that? And what kind of America to talk about. So we have to do this as a lesson to us to remember. It has to be something that is connecting to us rather than informing us.
When we're talking about climate change, something that actually needs great urgency and attention, I mean, it is hard to ignore the huge financial costs and structural barriers to make the drastic changes that are necessary to avoid catastrophe. So what can stories really do up against all of that?
Of course, you have to tell different stories to different audiences. And if you want to tell stories to someone who's working in finance, that story better have to encompass how you get rich, how you could save money, how you can live a better life financially. As a researcher, I've been looking into more than 500 companies around the world and how they make money and working with sustainability to enhance profitability as well as innovation. And that's the story I tell when I meet businessmen. How can we make our cars more energy efficient? Well, this is what Toyota done. This is what BMW's done. And then they start listening. The power of the example is also something that is important in the stories. Finding that whenever we tell a story about a day in the life of someone living in Malmö, that's actually a living example of someone living that sustainable life, a human being, rather than an individual in a PowerPoint presentation.
Per Grönqvist, the chief storyteller for Viable Cities, speaking with us from Stockholm. Thank you very much. Great to meet you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Remember back in September when India attempted to land a small spacecraft called Vikram on the moon? It crash-landed and the control center lost contact with it. India's space agency said they knew where Vikram crashed, but they didn't share the information. NASA couldn't find it for themselves until they got, what else, a tweet.
Initially, I sent a tweet, but on October 18, I sent an email with different pictures of old and new images. So after that, I think NASA looked a little more seriously and was able to find the location of the debris itself.
That's Shanmuga Subramanian. He's a mechanical engineer in Chennai in India. NASA sent him an email and said, nice work, and officially credited Subramanian with finding the moon lander debris. Subramanian spent hours comparing images of the moon taken before and after the Vikram mission, trying to find its debris.
So I did compare it with the old images that was something like 5 years back and 6 years back on the same spot. So I was just doing apples to apples comparison of the same spot. At last, I was able to find something that looked out of ordinary in that particular area.
When you sent your tweets to NASA with what you thought you'd found, did you think you would get a reply?
I didn't expect any kind of replies because NASA gets a lot of tweets.
You're a full-time mechanical engineer. How much time did you spend tracking all of this?
I watched all of ISRO's launches right from the scratch, and it got me more and more interested. And sometimes I do watch those International Space Station's videos. So I do keep a track of what has been going on in the space exploration areas.
On your website, Shanmuga, you call yourself a nerd, and I got to say, that was an insult when I was in high school. But nerds today embrace the word. Care to say a few words in praise of nerd power?
I don't think so, but I would still nerd above any other words, I would say.
Long live nerds. Shanmuga Subramanian, the mechanical engineer credited with locating India's Vikram lander, which crashed onto the moon in September. Shanmuga, thank you for speaking with us and congratulations again.
Thank you.
The lesson, I guess, is always look to the stars and the moon and the lunar satellite images. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.